Thank you for joining us. The following program is presented by Rico Cortez.
Shalom, shalom, and welcome back to Wisdom and Torah Ministries. We've been studying about the temple service and its daily service, and I hope and pray that that you will be enjoying this, and I hope you send me an email letting me know how you like it. Remember, researching, looking out for a lot of this information so you are able to really understand the temple in the time of Yeshua. So when you read the Brit Chadashah, the first century writings, you will have a greater understanding of everything that's happening around him, especially on John chapter 7. Verse 37, 38, 39. Now let's talk about the candlestick, the menorah. When we talk about the golden lampstand, it's also known as the candlestick, the menorah. It's a pure candlestick, the candlestick of Yahweh. It's golden lampstand. Okay, and it is prophetic foreshadowing of Messiah Yeshua as the light of the world. The details of the golden candlestick is this. 8 handbreadth high, 1.8 meters tall. Made of beaten fine solid gold. No other minerals. Only gold. And that's the mystery. How can you, you know, mathematically can have the branches? See, if there's gold, you know, the more pure the gold is, the softer it is. So how do you manage to get all that gold with fire on top of it? Fire on top of it, you know, with the oil that is not going to melt. That's the mystery. See, it tells us that the more we walk into holiness and the more we walk in the things of Yahweh, as we keep walking in His commandments, we become more like gold. See, we're striving to get to the gold pattern. That represents wholeness, fullness, righteousness, divinity, right? And we know when we go in the kingdom, we're going to live forever. There's not going to be any sin, so therefore we can live forever. That way we don't die. But it also represents the Messiah who is perfect in all His ways, who comes from the Father, and who is the light of the world, who is a servant. And we're going to keep looking more into the menorah as we keep reading here. There are 7 branches total, means perfection, and with 1 main branch, and 3 shoots of each side, 42 decorations. 42 decorations. The 3 stages of an almond plant are detailed from in an open bud or knob to flower then fruit. So you see every stage of an almond tree, you have it in the detail on the menorah. So, can I submit to you that the menorah may be the tree of life? There you go. He's in the holy place. Keep that in mind. It says, the lamb of oil rests on the fruit. The menorah was a sacred vessel, like the other vessels in the temple. During the festivals, it was guarded to ensure that it did not become impure and thus be deemed unfit for service. The menorah, made from a single piece of solid wood, stood in the southern side of the sanctuary. Each morning, a priest prepared and rekindled the wicks. The central wick, known as the Western candle. So it's really strange because the central one is known as the Western candle. Let me try to grab here. I'm sorry I'm going to do this, but I want to grab this menorah that we have here in the set. So I'll show you really what it is. Okay? It looks really big. See? This will be the centermost Western light. Somebody will think we'll be the farthest to the west, but they consider this one the most center. Bereshit, Bara, Elohim, Et, Alpha and the Omega, the Aleph and the Tav, the beginning and the end. You see, in the beginning, God created Aleph Tav, okay? Bereshit, Bara, Elohim, Et, Hashamayim, the heavens, Vaet, Haaretz. So we see here the 7 branches that has to do with the 7,000 years of humankind, okay? To the 7 days of creation, 7,000 days of humankind, and in the 4th day, by the end of 4,000 years, Yeshua, the Aleph on the top, the servant, the middle one is called the Shamash, which is a servant, right? And it has to do with fruit. Yeshua bear fruit. So as we see, the menorah gives us a great tool to understand who Yeshua really is and how He revealed Himself to His people Israel, okay? Now let's continue. The central western wick, known as the western lid, is required to burn perpetually. This one right here. This is the one that I told you earlier in the past programs that this one will go out every night in the evening, in the temple in the evening, and they have to go relit it. And they knew that after the great earthquake on Passover, actually when Yeshua died, the great earthquake from that point on, it will go out every night. This one, because it represents a servant. It represents the Aleph and the Tav, and according to the teachings, it will go out every night, meaning that something happens, something significant happens. The oil and the wicks of the candles are changed in such a fashion as to ensure that it will never be extinguished. The menorah stood in the southern part of the holy place, next to the veil. The menorah had 42 decorations that was the intrinsic part of the construction. 22 cups with almond-shaped embellishments, 9 flowers, 11 knobs, all integral parts of the body of the menorah. The menorah was 18 handbreadth high, the height of an average person. It was pretty big, from its base until the top. So there you go. You have Yeshua being the light of the world, who is the servant, who is the beginning and the end, the Aleph and the Tav. All these things happen in the candlestick, teaches us all about the Messiah. Not only how he's going to restore the heavens and the earth, not only that he's going to be the servant who's coming to bring the light on the world, but it has a distinct place in the heavenly tabernacle that we have to study. Now, the menorah was lit each evening, and the flame burned into the following morning. Fresh oil and new wicks were placed in the lamps every morning to prepare them for the lighting of the menorah in the evening. Each morning, the removable lamps were also cleaned and filled with a measure of 1/2 a log of olive oil each. The wicks were made of the priest's worn-out tunics and turbans. So anything that was old, you didn't do away with it, you didn't throw away. You basically used them as a way to put on the wicks for the menorah. The menorah has 42 decorations, which were all an essential part of this body. When the menorah was made of gold, it must feature these decorations. Even if only one of the decorations is missing, the menorah will be deemed unfit for use. However, if gold were not available and the menorah was made of a different metal, the decorations would not be required. In other words, you know, for the temple, it has to be gold, okay, and it has to have the decorations. If it's not gold, if he has the decorations and it's gold, it's not fit. If he has the decoration but it's not gold, it's not fit either. It's got to be gold and the decorations. Why? Because it typifies the tree of life in the garden in Eden. The menorah has 7 branches. Each was a uniform height, and the top of each branch was a lamp on which was filled with oil and wicks. The menorah symbolizes spiritual blessing. The Talmud states that whoever wishes to become wise should go south. And this is alluded by the location of the menorah in the south. The base of the menorah is called the Yerech in the Bible. At the base were 3 small feet. The feet contributed to the stability of the menorah. So basically, the menorah was established as a man. Okay, it has an average height of a person. It had like 3 little legs to give us stability. You know, so it's all a top and shadow of who we are. The design of the menorah. On the middle branch of the menorah near the base was a flower, and above it was a cup. Above these was a knob, and then another flower, the perach, okay? In the center of the middle branch were 3 knobs. From each one of these knobs, 2 branches extended, 1 to each side. At the top of each branch were 3 cups with almond-shaped embellishments, as well as the knob and flower. In total, there were 22 cups, 9 flowers, 11 knobs. You're probably saying, Rico, who cares? You know, it's just a candlestick. No, we better care. Because when the temples we dedicated in Jerusalem, it better have all of these. Now, what's interesting is the menorah that is in Jerusalem right now that the Temple Institute is setting up is not of 100% gold. And I did not know that until 2 years ago. Now, the mystery is this. How can you have perfect gold when you know that the more the gold is, more pure, the flimsy will be, the weaker it is? So how can you maintain them to be erect the whole time when they have fire on top? Eventually, you think they will melt, right? That's the ministry. That's the mystery, and that's when the Holy Spirit comes into play. The oil typifies the Ruach HaKodesh. The light typifies the Messiah. And the branches, you know, the tree is Israel, and those are the branches of Israel. And the only reason why we can stay up, erect, is by the help of the Holy Spirit to do that for us. Because if we have Messiah, we're striving to be holy as he was. So that's basically what we're trying to do. Here on the screen what you see is a big old picture of the temple in the indoors, okay, inside the temple, how they believe it was back then. You can see on the far side a big menorah to the south near the Holy of Holies. And they have, you see the 3 steps and you see the 7 branches and they're fixing it. Now, 3 stairs stood in front of the menorah. These stairs, made of stone, were used by the priests who tended to the light of the menorah. Since the menorah was the height of an average man, it was necessary to climb the stairs in order to reach the lamps of the menorah conveniently. These stairs were specially necessary for the high priest, since it was forbidden for him to raise his hands above the height of the golden crown he wore on his forehead. In other words, that's why, you know, the priests would never go, if they had the Kadosh La'adonai, the crown here, they weren't allowed to raise their hands above that. Always to shoulder width. Okay? It says, it was forbidden for him to raise his hands above the height of the golden crown who wore on the forehead, which bore the words Kadosh La'adonai, holiness unto the Lord. The tongue and the oil jar were placed on the second stairs after the lamp were prepared. You find that in the Tamid, in the Mishnah, Tamid 3:9. And here you're going to see it, because I'm showing you a picture right now that you see on the screen, the priest fixing the menorah on top of the third step, and you see the utensils, and the one I'm talking about, that is underneath, you see it being shown there by the arrow. Now, the holy temple instrument, the candlestick, the tongue that it's talking about on the brushes, that was what they used to use to fix the menorah and to clean it. A number of utensils were used to clean and prepare the menorah, and these were called the tongs and shovels. The menorah cleansing vessel included the main utensils, the kus, which was a golden receptacle that in which the ashes of the burned wicks were placed, the brush and the golden tongue, which was used to remove the burned wicks. They would clean them all the time. The lamps of the menorah were prepared each morning as a part of the tamid service. The cleaning and preparing of the lamps was divided in two stages. At first, only 5 lamps were prepared. The remaining 2 lamps were prepared after the blood of the tamid offering was dashed upon the altar. You can find that in Tamid 3:9 and 6:1 on the Mishnah. The cleaning utensils were placed on the second stair in front of the menorah after the 5 lamps were prepared. And you find that in the Mishnah, Tamid 3:9 and 6:1. Here in this picture, you see the whole thing, how it's happening. So each day, the priests attend to the service of the menorah, which consists of removing residue and spent wicks and oil from the individual lamps and preparing new wicks to be kindled. He must also replenish the full measure of oil for each light, which is half of a lug. This large oil pitcher is used to replenish the oil for the menorah, which has enough oil necessary for all 7 lamps. The design picture, okay, the design picture to the left base on the ancient coin from the end temple period, and the pitcher contains 3.5 lugs, 2 liters of oil, okay? The pitcher, they found one and that contained 2 liters of oil. That's how big it was, 2 liters. The small golden flask is used to pour olive into the menorah, the olive oil into the menorah. The priest pours out oil into the flask, okay, from the larger pitcher, which contains enough oil necessary for all 7 lamps. So you have 2 liters of oil for all 7 lamps. This smaller flask is used to replenish the oil in each individual lamp, which holds half of a lug. Okay, so now, let's talk about the 3 steps. Okay, it's called ascension. It's to ascend. These 3 steps correspond to the 3 biblical verses which mentions going up. In relation to the menorah, verse in Numbers 8:1 says, and the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the children of Aaron and say to him, when you raise up the lamps, 7 lamps shall illuminate the menorah. Okay, that's where they get it from. In Exodus 25:37 says, and you shall make it 7 lamps, and you shall cause its lamps to rise so that they shall shine towards the center. Okay, and then it says, and you shall command the children of Israel to bring a clear illuminating oil made from the hand-crushed olives to raise up a constantly burning, okay, 1 flame of the menorah. So basically what it is when he says that you go up, it means that you got to go up to be on top of it. It says, the western lamp burned perpetually. This candle was never extinguished, for the other flames were kindled from its fire. Concerning this flame, the verse states, raise up and constantly burning lamp. Leviticus 24:2-3. This is the second flame of the end of the east side. Okay, it is related that until the death of the high priest, Simeon the Just, listen to this, and it is related in the Talmud that until the death of Simeon the Just, the high priest, this flame burned constantly in miraculous fashion, which demonstrated to the world that the divine presence dwell among Israel. In the Beraitha, the Babylonian Talmud Shabbat 22:2, Rabbah, the teacher, says, what is the meaning by the words, you know, outside the curtain of testimony? The western candle is the testimony, for it was filled with the same amount of oil as of the others, but was not extinguished. In other words, they believed that the westernmost light, which is the centermost light of the menorah, that one always stayed lit, and it was always miraculous. And this is the one that typifies Messiah, and this is the one that serves as a testimony outside the Holy of Holies. Very important. And if you look at it, if you're looking from west to east from the temple, the menorah will be on the right-hand side, and the showbread will be on the left-hand side. So if the Father sitting on the throne looking from west to east to where you're at, so you will look at the menorah being the testimony to me and the light unto the world to my right. And we see that Yeshua will be the right, sits at the right hand of the Father, who is also the witness, okay, and the light. If the priest finds that the two eastern lamps have gone out, he prepares them for rekindling and lights them from the other flames. And if he should ever find that all the flames have been extinguished, he relights these two from fire atop the altar and then kindles the remaining five. Before leaving the sanctuary, he leaves the basket on the second step before the menorah and then he departs, okay? Now, hopefully you'll be able to see this on the screen really well, but I already showed you in the menorah that I have next to me, in which you see Bereshit, Bara, Elohim, Et, which Et is not translated into any word in English, but it means a pointer to a direct object. It means that it was the Aleph and the Tav, the Et, okay, who created the heavens and the earth. Okay? So it says Bereshit, Bara, Elohim, Et, who's also the servant, who is the beginning and the end, the Aleph and the Tav, whose light is the light of the world. You see how much meaning there is behind the menorah? So basically, we have a great tool in the temple service that speaks about the Messiah of Israel in its teaching. Listen, there's the seven spirits of Yahweh in the book of Isaiah. There's the 7 days of creation in regards to that, to the menorah. The 7,000 years of humankind. You can light it all up. So the same thing too. You got the moon, the stars, and the sun being created on the fourth day. So if we look again at the menorah, we have first day, second day, third day, fourth day. This happens to be the day in which the moon, the stars, and the suns were made. It happens to be the day that in the 4,000th year of creation, okay, 4,000 year, you have what? You have the prophets, you have the kings, okay, and then you have Yeshua being born, okay? And there, then you have the Aleph and the Tav, Yeshua, who's the beginning and the end, the Alpha and the Omega. He came at the end of 4,000 years to bring reconciliation to the earth and the heavens again. I mean, the teachings is incredible how much you can get out of it. Seven spirits of Yahweh. You have the, so much. I don't have enough time to do this right now, but I want to keep going because I'm going to be touching on a lot of this stuff later on. Now, I believe that the menorah is the tree of life. It's designed of an olive, as an almond tree. And what's interesting is that you see that Aaron's staff, which is an almond tree, which budded, and it was kept inside the Holy of Holies in the Ark of the Covenant. So you have now the testimony, who is the light of the world, who is, it's like a tree, like an almond tree right there, okay? And then you have Moses and Aaron, and then you have an almond tree. So you got to put all things together. The almond tree is found inside the holy place. Where Yeshua died, he died from the Mount of Olives looking in west to the holy place. Not to the Holy of Holies, but to the holy place. There were two veils in the temple. Okay, there was the veil on the outer court, or the door, or the structure going to the sanctuary. And there was the veil of the Holy of Holies. The one that rented was not the one in the Holy of Holies. The one that rented was the one outside in the door. Okay, that's something that we need to really investigate, because a lot of people don't know that. The one that really rented was the one outside on the sanctuary. They had a door, but they also had a veil. And that veil rented. And that's why we have access to the throne. We have access to the sanctuary, but you and I do not have access to the Holy of Holies because we're not high priests. Only Yeshua can go into the Holy of Holies because he's a high priest. Let's talk about the showbread. The table of showbread is also known as the showbread table. The showbread table, the table of is made of shittim wood, okay, acacia wood, and the table is overlaid with gold. The table is in the scripture. This is a prophetic shadow of representing Yeshua, the Messiah, as the bread of life and the bread of Yahweh, giving sustenance to Israel. Just like Yahweh gave manna in the wilderness to the children of Israel, so is he giving the bread as a presentation, as a of the presence there in the holy place for everybody to see. 12 loaves representing the 12 tribes of Israel. The details of the gold table of showbread are these. They have four corners with 4 feet, four gold rings, and every time you see gold rings, it represents eternity, the divine eternity, and rings signify eternity without end, eternal life. Four in the Bible, mathematic number for creation and the world. It measures 2 cubits by 1 cubit by a cubic and a half high, which is the same height as the brazen altar and the mercy seat, which is the Ark of the Covenant. There is a double crown border which measures its handbreadth apart. Now, this is a very significant thing to do, because one of the mysteries that even Rambam cannot explain is, why is it that the table of showbread and the altar of incense have a border around it that is a crown? It's a crown. This is a mystery. When you listen to the rabbinical writers, they don't really have any substantial, you know, teaching on that. They just don't quite understand it. There were 12 loaves of bread that were presented on the table vertically, which was sprinkled with frankincense and gold every week. Very interesting. They sprinkle it with gold and frankincense every week. These loaves were always on the table for display, and the old ones could only be eaten after the new ones were placed on the table on the Sabbath. Now, one of the central temple vessels is the golden table for the showbread. This is one of the main ones in the temple, which stands within the sanctuary itself on the north side. So you have the menorah on the south side. You have the golden altar on the center, you know, right there, right by before the veil. And you have the showbread on the north side, okay? This table is constructed of wood overlaid with gold. And the specific instructions for the son, you find them in Exodus chapter 25. Now, the priests are commanded to see to it that 12 loaves of bread are constantly displayed on this table before the presence of God. Hence, the name showbread says this in Exodus 25:30. And you shall place showbread on the table before me at all times. These 12 loaves were baked in pans, which gave them a specific form. And when done, they rested on golden shelves upon this table. The loaves were replaced every Sabbath with new ones, okay? Now, this is what we're going to talk about. The screen that you see now is going to show you what the design. They have vine, like a vine around it near a crown. Watch this. The table stood in the northern part of the sanctuary near the veil of curtain. The base of the table was made of wood and overlaid with gold. The dimensions were a cubit by 2 cubits, and it was 1.5 cubits high. The Bible describes the table in details, including its legs and top. The top part of the table was the frame. Above it was a garland of gold representing the crown of royalty, okay? Because the table represents material blessing and abundance in the world. Interesting, Yeshua is the bread of life. He has the crown of royalty who provides the bread to the people. Just like the angel in the wilderness, the messenger who was there leading them according to the world, to the way, and provided food for them to eat. Now, on both sides of the table were 4 branches. Now, these were like tall columns. They were like tall columns made of gold and split at the top, were the 2 rows of 6 shelves, each including the table base. Now, the shelves were formed by the golden half tube that connected between the branches opposite the other one, okay? The new loaves of showbread were placed on these shelves each Sabbath. Now, when the screen, you see what I mean. See, the way they were designed, the pieces of bread were huge, okay? The way they would do it was, let's say that this is the showbreads, all these are the showbreads for the week, and the Sabbath come around, they bring the other showbread, and because it says you should always have a presence in front of me, the bread in front of me, they never like took it out and left the space, then took the other one out. No, they put the one from the previous week, and the new loaves, they put them right next to each other, okay? And basically like this, and then they push these, and they got these in. So that way there will always be the presence. Always be the showbread of the presence. 2 of the 12 loaves of showbread were placed directly on the tabletop. Between these loaves, 2 frankincense censers were placed. That really kept it fresh, by the way. The branches of the table had half tubes, which were 4 shelves on which the showbread loaves placed. It looks like it was more or less like a tube. You see it on the screen right now. When you see this, you're going to see what I mean. Since the loaves were placed on these tubes and air could circulate through and between them, and the bread would not become moldy. Okay, each showbread loaf was made of 2 ezronim, of fine wheat, flour, and water. This bread was unleavened bread. Okay, no sin there. Just like Yeshua was no sin, this bread was unleavened. Okay, the loaves were each kneaded separately. Okay, they were then baked in pairs in the oven in the place of the hearth. Okay, that's where the baker would do that. So there was a priest whose only job was to bake the bread. Each loaf was placed in a pan called the defos, which was a special mold. The mold preserved the unique shape of the loaves, described by the sages as being similar to an open box. its dimensions were 10 hand breadth. A hand breadth is this. So there were like 10 of these like this. It's pretty long. It's probably about this. Maybe a little longer. It says, and 5 hand breadth of width. You find that in the source of the Mishnah, Menachot 11. The sages also relate that after eating only a small portion of the bread, the size of an olive, the priest will eat and become satiated, become full, as if I've eaten an entire meal. Now, this is very significant because in the Hebrew roots understanding, when we keep Sabbath, we have, on Shabbat, we have bread and we have wine. And a lot of people mistakenly believe that's probably what is called the Last Supper. And that's not what it is. Communion. We don't take communion. Communion comes from Mithraism. Communion comes from a pagan observance that was added in by the Catholic Church. That's not what we're doing. When we keep Sabbath, we eat of the bread and we bless the bread. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam, hamotzi lechem min haaretz. And then we bless the wine. Blessed are you, O Lord, King of the universe. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam, borei pri hagafen. So what we do is we partake of the wine and the bread, because in the temple times, when the Sabbath will come, the bread that was there for the whole week, they will take it out and they divide up the old bread for the week, which, by the way, one of the miracles of the temple was that they could eat a small piece and they would be full, and the bread was as fresh as in the day they made it. So this is one of the miracles of the temple that you really need to be aware of, very, very important. And here we see that they used to have wine in the temple, and they drank the wine, and they drank the wine, and they ate the bread. So therefore, they would do that every Sabbath. So that's why we're keeping that temple service tradition, blessing the Creator for the sustenance on the week, for the double portion on Shabbat, and drinking of the wine of the fruit of the vine. Okay. The showbread was eaten by the priests in the showbread chamber. Each Sabbath, the showbread was then removed from the table, was distributed to the priest. The priest watch that was commencing the week observing would take 6 loaves in the northern part of the court, and the watch that completed the week of the service received the remaining 6 in the south. In other words, you got 2 shifts, one leaving and one coming in. So they divided it up. 6 loaves for the shift of priests that were there for the whole week, and 6 loaves for the shift of priests that were coming in for the next week. So that's how they did it. It should be noted that the high priest was eligible to receive up to 6 loaves from the general number of showbread loaves. You find that in Sukkah 5:8 and Yomah 17. 5 and 6, you get 6 loaves there. So the priest always had a little bit of a greater privilege. The frankincense censers, called spoons by the Bible, were 2 small golden vessels in which the frankincense was placed. The frankincense censer was placed between the 2 rows of the showbread of the table. Why? To keep it fresh, to maintain the flies forever getting on top of them. It also served as maintaining no mold in it, so keep it fresh. So imagine if frankincense and some of those herbs keep you from getting mold when you take essential oils and things like that. It keeps you from getting mold in your body. You know, candida is a form of mold. It's yeast. So, molding stuff, when you eat anything molding, you can get candida and you can die from that. Now, Menachot 11:5, the source of this, says this. The frankincense censers were placed on the tables together with the showbread each Sabbath. On the following Sabbath, when the showbread loaves were replaced with the new ones, frankincense was also replaced. Once removed from the table, the frankincense will burn on the incense wood pile on the outer mitzvah. They will take that frankincense and they will put it on the altar outside in the great altar. Okay? Now, the Talmud describes that a miracle took place every week. When the priest came to replace the bread with new loaves every Sabbath, they found that those of the previous week remained fresh and hot upon the table, like the moment they were baked. This miracle was seen as a clear confirmation that the divine presence indeed rested in the holy place. So they always had signs to know that Yahweh was moving in the midst of Israel. You know, they didn't do things, just for the heck of it. So you always knew, that the Father was there, because either the light was always lit, the westernmost light of the menorah, or you have the showbread was always warm and always fresh. Now, these 2 tables stood in the ulam. There are 2 tables now that they are basically in the ulam, in the entrance of the sanctuary, okay? One table was made of marble, and the other one was made of gold. It's very interesting. They had 2 different tables, and they divided it up. They divided up the bread there. And it says, one table was made of marble, and others say silver and looked like marble. The second table was made specifically made of gold because the principle that we increase in the level of holiness and do not decrease, okay? Since the loaves were already in the golden table in the sanctuary, they could not be removed and placed on a table less of splendor. So what they will say is, man, this was already in the golden in the showbread, the table of showbread, and that's made of acacia wood and gold. Acacia is indestructible wood. Let's find Messiah in the table of showbread. Acacia, according to the Septuagint, is like incorruptible wood. Not even a piece of worm can penetrate it. It's so hard, okay? So basically, we see Messiah all over it. He's incorruptible. He came in the flesh, but he's incorruptible. He lives forever. He's dressed of the pre-existent, if you want to call the word divine or pre-existent. Okay? He gives the bread of life to the people. Okay? And he has a crown around it, the crown of royalty. Okay, that's our Messiah who brings forth bread to the 12 tribes of Israel and who always brings the sweet aroma of the frankincense to make sure that we never go moldy, that we never go old, that we always stay fresh. That's the teaching of the table of showbread. The new loaves of showbread were placed on the marble table before Shabbat. So as we see here, the new loaves of showbread were placed on the marble table before Shabbat, before being transferred to the table of the showbread in the holy place. The outgoing loaves that were removed from the showbread were first placed on the golden table, and afterwards they were distributed to the priests. You find that in Midot 3:7, Menachot 11:7, and Shekalim 6:4 in the Mishnah. The young priestly trainees also entered into this area to see the golden crowns. So what they would do before they would do anything, they would bring the loaves before they would go into the table of showbread. They pull it on the marble table. Okay. Once they put it there, then they take it to the golden altar of the presence of the showbread, and then they remove the previous table, previous loaves when the new ones, right, that already were in the marble table. They remove the ones that were already on the table of showbread, which is gold, and then they take it out to the ulam, and they put it on the golden table now. You understand? Because you don't want to put anything that's been in the presence of the God in the golden table of a lesser value. So they kept it in the gold, and then they ate it. That's how they did it. How about if we talk a little bit about the incense on the temple? The altar of incense, that's what we're going to talk about, and the incense. So we're going to talk about all kinds of stuff because, you see, each incense had a healing properties. Each incense had healing properties, something that we need to understand. Okay? The altar of incense, also known in the scripture as the incense altar, the altar of gold, the golden altar, the altar of burnt incense, the altar of sweet incense, the altar before the Lord, the whole altar, that is, by the oracle, the altar of incense, is a prophetic picture of Yeshua as our intercessor. The details of the altar of incense are this: measured 1 cubit by 1 cubit by 2. 1 cubit by 1 cubit by 2 cubits high. Okay? Had 4 horns total. Why? Because it's 4 corners of the earth, and you atone, you put blood on the 4 corners to bring the dispersal of Israel from the 4 corners of the earth. One of each corner, like the brazing altar, just like outside was inside, was 4 square like the brazing altar in the Holy of Holies, okay? Located at the heart of the tabernacle. In other words, if you go back and you study Exodus 25, you're going to find out that the altar of incense was the last thing that was put into the tabernacle. You started with the Ark of the Covenant. You went out with the older utensils, things that are in the menorah, the showbread. You went in with the laver. You went in with the altar, you went in with everything in the temple, and it finishes with the altar of incense. Why does it start? Does it stop with the last thing, the altar of incense? Because that typifies the prayers of the saints. Okay, incense was taken off of the incense altar and placed into the priest's censer. This is very important because the priest's censer, that was what he used to go into the Holy of Holies. Okay, the incense altar stood between the showbread and the menorah, a bit to the east. The incense altar was built of wood overlaid with gold and was thus known as the golden altar. Again, you know, golden, the acacia wood, which is shittim wood, same thing. 4 horns protruded from the top of each of the 4 corners of the altar. On these 4 horns, blood of the inner sin offering was sprinkled, starting with a northern eastern horn, ending with a southeastern horn. They always did it the same way. Okay, they started with the northern eastern, and they finished with the southern eastern horn of the altar of incense. You find that in Eruvim. Eruvim 19. Around the horn of the altar, there was a golden wrath, symbolizing the crown of the priesthood. You see, it got, you know, go around, it's like golden. It had like a crown, like the golden priesthood with the vines in it. It's real pretty. The incense altar is called the golden altar, was one of the three vessels located in the holy place. The incense was burned twice each day on top of the incense altar, okay? On top of the altar, they put in incense on that. The altar symbolizes the golden mean. Okay, a golden mean. In other words, you go in there and you intercede on behalf of Israel. The moderate path with regard to attributed behavior. The altar is seen as representing the balanced combination of spiritual and material abundance. Very significant. Because see, the top of the incense or golden altar was made of pure gold. The thickness of it is like a coin, like a dinner. The Talmud relates that it was a miracle that the coals did not melt the gold. Despite the thickness, just like in the outer altar, which was of copper or brass, you know, in the 410 years of the story between the tabernacle in the wilderness to the destruction of the first temple, the altar of incense, the altar outside, the big altar, it was basically, they believed that in Solomon's time it was cast with brass, okay, stones and brass, so it never melted. And then the tabernacle, the wood, remember it was acacia wood overlaid with brass or copper. You know, it never deteriorated the copper. And on the same token, it never messed up the wood inside. It's a miracle in itself. So we keep going. The altar incense, the golden altar of incense, was a sacred vessel like the other vessels in the temple. There is an opinion of one of the commentaries that during the time of the first temple, the altar was part of the temple structure. Okay? Incense was offered twice daily, in the morning and at twilight. Very important, okay? In Luke chapter 1, you're going to see this parallel. In the story of Zechariah, when he's doing the Shmoneh Esrei. The Shmoneh Esrei are the weekly services, and you find it in the Siddur, the Arch Scroll. You find it in the morning service. You have 18 benedictions. And what's interesting is Zechariah was praying the same prayers in the altar where he's doing the offering of the sacrifice or the incense there that day. That was his only time ever that he received that job, the privilege to do that particular offering. And here we see that he was doing prayers, and the angel appears to him. So as you read here, verse 5 of chapter 1, there was in the days of Herod, king of Judea, a certain priest named Zechariah, of the course of Abia, and his wife was a daughter of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. And they were both righteous before Elohim, walking in all the commandments and ordinances of the Lord, blameless. Verse 8, and it came to pass that while he executed the priest's office before Elohim in the order of his course, according to the custom of the priest's office, his lot was to burn incense when he went in into the temple of the Lord. You see, so he received that for the first time in his life, he received the lot. He basically says, it's my time to go in. And here he goes in. What happened to him? Listen to this verse. Verse 10, Luke chapter 1. And the whole multitude of the people were praying without. They were praying outside at the time of the incense. Why were they praying? Well, you find the prayers right here. They were doing the morning tamid. They were doing the prayers in the morning service. Okay, and in the afternoon too. Verse 12, then Zechariah saw him. He was troubled and fair. In other words, as soon as he's praying, you know, he keep praying. And there appeared unto him an angel of the Lord standing on the right side of the altar of incense. So here we see that he's praying certain prayers. Everybody's praying at the same time. And what happens? The angel appears. Okay, very important. So, as we continue the details, you know, we got to go into the ingredients of the incense. Now, the Bible states that God said to Moses, take fragrance such as balsam, onecha, galbanum, and pure frankincense, all of the same weight, as well as other specific fragrances. Exodus 30:34. The incense which we offer in the holy temple was made from 11 different ingredients, only 4 of which are mentioned by name in the verse above. The identity of the other 7 have been passed down in the oral tradition. Now, there's a family who just, you know, basically all they do is take care of the incense. And they know the one herb that basically causes the fire to go up in a column. And this is really interesting because nobody else knew how to do that except them. This is why when every time they try to destroy Israel, they go to the families of the priests and they get rid of them. They get rid of the incense people, they get rid of the bread people, they get rid of the writers of the Torah, they get rid of the musicians, because they preserve the traditions within their family. If your family was in charge of the music, you only did the music. If they were in charge of the bread, you only did the bread. If they were in charge of the incense, they only did the incense. So what happens is they were very zealous for the job that Yahweh gave them. Now, listen, man, there's a lot of stuff that I'm telling you right here, and a lot of it is not really anything new. It's research that I've done to help you understand some of the things that we know. And later on, as we keep doing this, we're going to start connecting all of these things to Yeshua. But I need you to understand what's happening in the temple during the time of Yeshua, because when he will go to the feast, now you have a vivid picture of what was happening in the altar, what was happening, what time were they going in to pray, what time were they going in to do the blessing, what time were going in and doing the other sacrifices and the other duties, you know, how were they sing, so you can have a picture of what's happening around you. This is very important. Not many people take the time to study it because, oh, there's no temple. But they don't realize that when the millennial reign comes, there will be a temple and all of this will be reestablished again. All right. As in the case with regard to any other areas in the temple study, the exact classification of these ingredients is a subject of serious research and scholarship. Many of these are rare, and some can be obtained through exotic and distant lands. Now watch. The method or recipe for preparing the special incense offering from this ingredient was closely guarded secret, passed down from generation to generation within the ranks of one particular family known as Aptinas. Okay. In addition to this, identity of the spices and the exact amount and manner in which they are prepared, the clan protected another important secret in their trade, the identity of the herb known in Hebrew as Ma'ale Asham. Okay, literally means that which comes up in smoke rising, smoke to rise. This herb has the quality which enables the smoke from the incense to rise up to heaven in a straight column. That's one of the miracles of the temple, by the way. It didn't matter how much it rained, that column and the outer altar, you know, not the one in the golden altar. I'm going to go a little different direction right now. But the one in the outer altar, no matter how much it rained, you know what? It always went up as a column, as a sweet aroma unto the nostrils. So if you will go to the temple and you want to know if the Father's pleased with you, well, first of all, you got to imagine. You close your eyes and imagine with me. What would it be like to, you know, be in the temple of Israel? You look down and you see the priests singing in one accord, one consent, one mind, one soul, one purpose. Then you see all the priests casting lots to do the duty. And then you see, you bring an animal, you put your hands on it, you repent, then you kill it, then you give it to the priest for getting the blood, and then he presents it for you, and he prepares the meat. And there you are expecting, great expectation, because you're presenting an offering unto the Creator, and all of a sudden, when he puts the meat on the altar, it goes up as a cloud directly to the heavens, and you can just smell. It's like a steakhouse. You know what I mean? It's like a steakhouse. It must have been incredible, the flavor. You know, and the smell of a kosher animal mixed with salt, you know, and you go in there, so you know when the Lord was pleased. In our own time, some have speculated this may be the plant, Leptadenia, I can't pronounce the last one, that's a long word, which contains nitric acid. So they think that one particular herb is the one that they did, but they're not quite sure. Now, the priest who have received the task of offering the incense takes up the special vessel, in the incense service, a large golden spoon which holds the amount of 3 kavim and a smaller vessel. They have to get the amount of a handful filled with brim to the with the incense and placed inside a large vessel. This prevented any of the incense from spilling. Now listen, this was very significant service because they were not allowed to even one grain of the herb to hit the ground, because this service typified the prayers of Israel going up in smoke to the Father as sweet aroma unto the nostrils of the Creator. Now the priest who attends to the incense service enters into the sanctuary together with one colleague who will assist them. We're talking about the regular weekly altar of incense offering. We're not talking about Yom Kippur, okay? He removes the smaller vessel filled with the incense and hands it to his companion. The latter deposits some of the incense into the palm of the priest. So you got to put them in here. There's a particular method of doing it, okay? As mentioned before, the incense service only came about once in each priest's life. Okay, therefore, the priest who will now officiate has no prior experience. Before he entered, he was warned that he must be very cautious when placing the incense upon the burning coals. If he sprinkle it on the coals too close on the side where he's standing, he will be burnt. He is instructed that he must sprinkle it in the motion moving away. So he had to basically move away from us. He do that so he would not get burned. When he receives word from the overseer that he may now begin, the priest begins to let the grain fall from the palm across the top of the altar slowly, like one who sifts flour. That's what Maimonides says. When the entire chamber fills with cloud of smoke, he prostrated himself and exited the sanctuary. And you never turn your back to the Creator when you leave the sanctuary. You always move backwards because you were in the presence of the King and you don't want to turn your face and you want to turn your back to the King. When you meet with him, you step back. Now, one of the things you have to remember is that the Aptinas family, Aptinas, which was located south on the second story above the water gate. If you see in the screen right there, see the chamber of Aptinas, which is the picture of the temple there. And when you're looking from south to north, and there you see above that water gate there, that's where they have the place where they make the incense. The Aptinas family was appointed by the Sanhedrin to provide the incense, and they were exclusively responsible for its production, which was done in the chamber named for them, the Chamber of Aptinas. We have learned that this chamber was located in the south side of the court over the water gate. Okay? Now, this is very important because they understood and they had their secret of understanding how to make the herbs smoke go up in one thing. Very powerful, okay? Let's talk about the quantity of the incense, ingredients and details of the incense. The quantity of the ingredients for the incense itself is also significant. It corresponds to the amount prepared for 1 year of daily temple service. The Torah only lists four ingredients of the ketoret, of the incense, okay? The Mishnah lists 11 ingredients in addition to sodom, salt, and carcina lyre, okay? The latter text also tells of the Aptina families of how they were charged with the secret of compounding these precious spices. The fragrance of the incense was said to be so powerful that when it was being prepared, one could smell it as far away as Jericho. Where the women, it was also said, did not wear perfume because of the scent. Jericho is about 12 miles from north of the Qumran. Now, again, this is an idiomatic expression. You know, have you ever heard somebody says, man, you talk so loud, I can hear you all the way down in New York. You know, something like that. Puerto Rico, it's better in Spanish. Okay? But here it's saying that the fragrance of the incense was so powerful that you can smell it. It's like saying, man, the incense was so beautiful and it's so awesome and it's so powerful. Man, you can smell it all the way to Jericho. You know, it's not like it really got there, but you know what I mean. Now, curiously, when Young Muhammad, okay, discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls in 1947, as the guy who discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls, only two of the 10 clays of jars contained anything. Okay, one of the pots held the scrolls, and the other was filled with what was described as a reddish earth. Okay? Now, this is a sample from the Temple Institute that you see there on the screen. You see it there. And those of you that are listening to me, you can go to my website, www.wisdomandtorah.com, and there you'll be able to see the PowerPoint. You can follow along, okay? Now, what's interesting is they found like a reddish, dirtish thing, like dirt, okay? Now, with the discovery of the actual sample hidden away in the Qumran caves, no one knew the exact biblical botanical use. Now, what's interesting is that Wendell Jones examined samples of the temple incense found in 1992 dig, and estimated 600 pounds they found of what looked like reddish earth was uncovered on the north entrance of the cave of the column by excavation volunteers in the late spring of 1992. Now, team members reported detecting a smell of cinnamon present in the substance. Preliminary analysis by Dr. Marvin Antleman of the Weizmann Institute revealed that the finding was indeed organic. Now, this is the quote. Density indicates that the material which is lighter than water is excluded from the category of red soil and red minerals. Also, the high percentage of ash is typical of plant source. So they understood that this was the herbs from the temple service. Now, Dr. Antelman later told the Jerusalem Post in a story date May 1st, 1992, he says, "I am very excited about this find. He had positively identified borit carcina, carcina lai, which is one of the ingredients spelled out in the Talmud." So now, recently, Dr. Terry Hutter performed a more exhaustive analysis and stated that, quote, "The red-brown spice sample is composed of 9 different and unique plants. The plants are recognizable both by pollen and organic marsupial types," end quote. Now, Dr. Hutter listed these as 3 kinds of cinnamon, saffron balsam, myrrh, galbanum, cassia, and frankincense. Interesting. They found some of the incense of the temple. Very important. See, in looking at history of incense and the spice routes, the fascinating part is that the majority of biblical scents mentioned were imported from countries as far as China and as close as Lebanon. You know, Elohim not only chose to import those spices from foreign lands, but also chose to plant them in this land. God fully knowing a particular point in the history of Israel, he will gather the spices to present the sweet-smelling oblation of himself through the Levitical priests. This is very significant because through the Solomon's Temple and all that stuff, remember, you got to remember, when you go to the Middle East and you go to Israel, you know, when you go to Israel, if you want to come to Israel with me, please come. I'll usually go the last week of November and all the middle part or the first part of November and the last week of October. I'm sorry. The last week of October and the early parts of November, usually I always take a tour to Israel. And I hope you join me because when you go to the shuk, when you go to the market, you see all of these spices right there. I mean, those people eat a lot of spices with their food. And it's very significant when you start really understanding what the spices really mean. Okay, we got a few more minutes, and I want to cover the Ark of the Covenant. Now, the Ark of the Covenant is known in Scripture as the Ark of the Testimony, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, the Ark of the Covenant of Elohim. So, basically, it's made up of acacia wood overlaid with gold. Again, overlaid with gold. The Ark of the Covenant contained the mercy seat of Yahweh and was the only furniture located inside of the Holy of Holies, the most holy place of the sanctuary and the temple behind the veil. The Ark is a prophetic shadow picture of Yeshua, of whom Yahweh holds his Torah inside. You see, the Ark, let's say that the Father has no image or form. But what's really interesting is that the Ten Commandments were inside the Ark of the Covenant. It's as if the Word comes from within the Father, you know? Now, the details of the Ark of the Covenant, made of acacia wood, overlaid with gold. Dimensions were 2.5 cubits by 1.5 cubits by 1.5 cubits, okay? It's the same dimensions as the showbread and the same dimensions as the altar of incense. Gold was located inside with wood as the core and gold outside, inside and outside the box. The 2 staves and the 4 golden rings. Remember, gold rings means eternity. And there were 2 poles, okay, to carry and move the Ark without touching it. You know, they had 2 cherubims with wings on each side on top. You know, holds the 2 tablets of the commandments. It has also the rod that budded, the manna. And the manna was inside. I believe that the rod of Moses was on the outside. It represents the throne of Yahweh. It represents the presence and the glory of Yahweh, the Creator. You know what it is? And what it is there, the high priest, Yeshua, who's the high priest, goes into the Holy of Holies to intercede on our behalf. Now, what's interesting that in the Second Temple period, there was no Ark of the Covenant. Basically, it was just empty. Only the foundation stone was there. So this is very significant because, you know, as you look in, there's a prophecy that says that the glory of the Second Temple will be greater than the first. Well, how can that be? When in fact, there was no Ark of the Covenant during the Second Temple period. And even to this day, they're still trying to find it. One of the kings of Israel hid it so the Babylonians would not take it away with them. And to this day, we don't know where it is. Okay, so we need to understand that everything that happened in the temple and you know, is important because it typifies who Yahweh the Father is. You know, what is the work of the Creator? What is meant that He should be so mindful of us? Why should He desire to be able to come to us and reveal Himself in a way that, in a tangible way? Why would He want that? I don't know why, but He's merciful and He's loving. Now, the Ark of the Covenant is very important because I remember there was one of the priests, I forgot his name right now, One of the priests, when David was bringing the Ark of the Covenant from the Philistines, they were brought over, and they brought it in the wrong place. They didn't know how to do it right back then. I don't know why, but they didn't. They tried to put it on the bull, on the oxen. And then when it tried to move, one of the priests tried to touch it, Uzzah, tried to touch it, and he basically died on the spot. Okay, in other words, you do not have to carry the presence of the Lord. You know? Now, it's interesting because you have to, supposedly you have Levites that are supposed to carry it, but in reality, the legend is that it never really was that heavy to them. They were just there carrying it, but it was actually light. You know, and there's something about the presence of Yah. You don't have to try to carry the presence of Yahweh. The presence of Yah comes upon you because you have to be a worthy vessel. Okay? You have to be a worthy vessel. So as we see, there's a lot of utensils, and there's a lot of things that we use for the Ark of the Covenant. You know, the priests, and when we do the Yom Kippur sacrifice in the temple, you're going to see more evidence of this. So right now, I hope you enjoy this, and you pray. Remember, the Messiah is all over it. You know, this is all about Messiah. This is going to be a series of teachings about the temple. We're going to connect not only the daily sacrifices, how they will go in. Remember, you can only go into the Holy of Holies once a year. Doing the daily sacrifice, no one can go in there. Only the high priest can go in there once a year. That's where the presence, the Shekhinah of Yahweh would dwell. You know, there's so much to talk about. And there's so much information that we need to recognize that if we learn those principles, we'll be able to understand Scripture a lot better. The book of Revelation is all about the temple service. It's all about the sacrificial system. It's all about the priestly order. And it's all about prayer and the altar of incense. And it's all about the Sabbath, which is the millennial reign. If you do not have a deep understanding of the temple service or the tabernacle, the book of Revelation is not going to make any sense to you. So this is something that I want you to keep in mind. Because as we study, many people don't realize that. As we study, many people try to do many things that try to reinvent the wheel, and you don't have to do that, okay? Now, later on, we're going to be talking about the laver, the copper laver. And we touch some other subjects as we go along, okay? May Yahweh bless you and keep you. Remember, do not believe anything that I say. Go verify this. All this information is research that I compiled with the help of some people that helped me put the PowerPoints together so that you will benefit to understand the panorama. Like if you go in the temple, would you know where the priest will be? Do you know how they cast lots? Do you know who was supposed to go into the holy place? That's the intent. Remember Yahweh's truth. His Torah is truth. Yeshua is the living word, and he is truth. Yahweh bless you and keep you. We'll see you next time. Shalom Aleichem.
If you would like more information about Wisdom and Torah and any other future teachings, please visit www.wisdomintorah.com. Now we leave you with the Aaronic blessing. Shalom.
V'yishmerecha Ya'er Adonai Panav alecha v'chunecha Yisa Pana elecha ve'asem lecha lecha shalom.
May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you shalom. Amen.